طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinians' struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and continued in his memory by a group of his colleagues. This is John Roberts. The fact that Israel actively spies on the United States, both at the government level and within the private sector, particularly the technology sector, is well known. Spying has been going on both ways for a long, long time. In fact, super spy Jonathan Pollard, who was serving a life sentence in a U.S. prison for spying for Israel, has been in the news lately as possible trade fodder to promote a possible swap with Israel if Israel would release certain Palestinian prisoners, all in the interest of keeping the dying peace process going until at least after the 2014 election. Now, in an article written by Nancy Murray, and with information made public by Edward Snowden, we get a glimpse of how the spying mechanisms of Israel and the United States are so entwined that they become a mutual spying system serving both the United States and Israel. Who knew? And now that we do know, why is it not this mutual information sharing system widely discussed and evaluated? The spying technology operated by Israeli firms under contract by the United States is frightening, and we would not know the half of it without the leaked revelations by Edward Snowden. The information gathering is so intertwined between the two countries that spying is no longer the appropriate word for access to each other's information, including information gathered on regular people, such as the NSA's snooping mechanisms fueled by Israeli technology. Want to hear more? Here are excerpts from Nancy Murray's expose, written for the blog Mondo Weiss. Now it appears that the Israeli government has ordered its spies to dig up intelligence showing links between the supporters of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Campaign, BDS, and so-called terrorists and enemy states, as reported in the February 11, 2014 London Times. However, it may find that it already has such information, the information that it needs in its own databanks from its current operations. As described in the UK Guardian by Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and Ewan McCaskill, a 2008 document obtained by whistleblower Edward Snowden states that, quote, one of the NSA's biggest threats is actually from friendly intelligence services like Israel. There are parameters on what NSA shares with them, but the exchange is so robust, we sometimes share more than we intended, unquote. Nevertheless, in the following year, the NSA and the Israeli Syngent National Unit drafted a top-secret memorandum of understanding, dated March 2009, under which the NSA would provide raw intelligence to Israel, including on American citizens. The memorandum requested Israel intelligence to destroy upon recognition communications going to and from officials of the executive branch, including the White House, cabinet departments, and independent agencies, the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate, members and staff, And the U.S. federal court system, including but not limited to the Supreme Court, as well as communications of civilian and military personnel on official business of government. It is not clear if the memorandum revealed by Snowden was ever implemented, but if it was, Israeli intelligence services might be receiving little data that they don't already possess, including communications of U.S. government officials and members of Congress. This will not be news in the wake of Snowden's revelations about the NSA's PRISM program, featured in a piece by Max Blumenthal on the critical role played by such Israeli-linked high-tech companies as Narus and Verint in intercepting all forms of network communications for the NSA. Thanks to the investigative work done by pioneering analyst of the NSA, James Banford, in his book, The Shadow Factory, and numerous articles journalist Christopher Ketchum and Carl Cameron in his Fox News four-part report on Israeli spying in the U.S. soon after 9/11, we know that the products of several Israeli-originated companies with alleged ties to the Israeli intelligence, especially its secretive version of the NSA Unit 8200, and military services appear to have been embedded in U.S. communication systems well before 9/11. And, in the words of former commander of Unit 8200, quote, dominate the U.S. eavesdropping and surveillance market, unquote. Christopher Ketchum, in Counterpunch in September 2008, made a persuasive case speculating that Israeli backdoor technology penetrated the U.S. government's telecom system and compromised national security in the 1990s. When Congress in 1994 passed the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, requiring telephone networks to install equipment that would enable the government to conduct wiretaps, the Israeli company Comverse Infosys, now Verint Systems, had the technology to do the job of lawful interception. Verint soon had contracts with a wide range of U.S. government agencies, including the NSA and law enforcement, as well as major telecommunications companies like Verizon, to handle electronic interception or wiretaps. Narus handled interceptions at AT&T, while the Israeli company Amdocs Limited collected the metadata for all U.S. call and billing records, including the White House and FBI, information that might have been funneled to Israel intelligence. Ketchum quoted former CIA case officer David Steele, quote, Israeli penetration of the entire U.S. telecommunications system means that NSA's warrantless wiretapping actually means Israeli warrantless wiretapping, unquote. Is this really the case? In the wake of Edward Snowden's revelations about the dimensions and intrusiveness of the U.S. national security surveillance state, you might have expected this question to get the kind of mainstream attention that would eventually produce some hard proof, one way or the other. But it hasn't, in the United States at any rate. Interestingly, when Ryan Gallagher, writing for Slate's Future Tense, invited readers to meet the American company helping governments spy on billions of communications, he described Verint as headquartered in Melville, New York, and never mentions its Israeli connection, except when listing Israel as one of the many countries in which its 16 offices were based. But in Israel, there has been little effort to keep the matter under wraps. Quote, in U.S. snooping affair, Israeli firms at risk, was the headline in Haaretz, which described the involvement of Israeli companies in the U.S. spying machine, and spelled out the concerns that the manufacturers themselves have the ability to spy from afar. And on the Israeli website IHLS.com, which describes itself as Israel's homeland security home, Amduran lays out what is known about the Israeli intelligence unit 8200's involvement with high-tech surveillance in the U.S. and cites testimony by the NSA chief Keith Alexander about two companies with ties to Israel secretly eavesdropping on American internal communications. So is there anything we can do to force a discussion of Israelis' role in the national security surveillance state onto the public agenda here in the United States? The time certainly appears ripe for such action. A recent poll indicates that the majority of Americans now consider Edward Snowden a whistleblower and think his disclosures about dragnet surveillance are good for the country. The NSA is on the defensive, with serious pushback, not just from people who care about privacy and the Constitution, but from the high-tech business community and within Congress. We now have the opportunity to build valuable alliances with groups concerned to roll back the components of the police state that NSA whistleblower William Binney fears we have already become. One potential hook for raising pertinent questions is the USA Freedom Act, introduced on September 29, 2013, in the House by Republican Representative Jim Sensenbrenner, who now regrets many of the powers he put in the U.S. Patriot Act, and the Senate by Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy. It would implement reforms described here. It has 143 co-sponsors in the House, including Representatives Capuano, Clark, Keating, Lynch, McGovern, Neal, and Tierney from Massachusetts, and 21 co-sponsors in the Senate, including our senators, Markey and Warren. If our elected officials are co-sponsoring the USA Freedom Act, you can contact them and thank them for their support of this important legislation. And then you can ask them if they would be willing to investigate the possible role played by Israeli-linked high-tech companies in the mass surveillance of Americans, which would include members of Congress. Well, enough about the mutual snooping efforts of the U.S. and Israeli governments, as well as the private sector technology companies. It is a study in codependency that helps us understand why it is so difficult for us to challenge the United States' support of the Israeli occupation. And now on to our feature presentation this morning. It is an address by renowned Palestinian geographer, researcher, and author Salman Abu Sita. In a presentation entitled "The Geography of Occupation," Abu Sita tells his family story, which is the story shared by hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were driven off their land in 1948, creating the largest refugee population that still exists to this day.
Ethnic cleansing policy was a fundamental principle of Zionism, that we want the land, we do not want the people. I became a refugee when I was in a boarding school about 40 kilometers away from my home place. And in April 1948, the headmaster came to us and said, "The Jews are attacking people around Tel Aviv in Jaffa area. They will soon come to our area. I cannot protect you, so you better go home now, quite a bit early, maybe 6 weeks early, before the end of the scholastic year." And I was about 10 at the time, and the distance between the boarding school and my home is about 40 to 60 kilometers, depending on how you do it. And the road to my home was cut off frequently by Zionist soldiers who were riding in jeeps, and the jeeps, I remember clearly, had two machine guns, one pointing forward and the other one pointing backward. And so they would go at terrific speed in the area, in which they have no physical presence, except they have garrisons of 30 soldiers in certain locations. They would terrify the farmers, and they would drive on the roads and in the fields, and they shoot anybody in sight. So I have a cousin who was older than me, about 20 years age at that time, and he said, "Let us walk back home." And he advised us that if you see these jeeps coming, you have to hide in the wheat field, which was then very much in evidence, until you hear the sound of the jeep going away. So we did that, and on the way I had to throw away my bag, my clothes and my books, and we had to walk about 40 kilometers, terrified as a child that one moment we see the jeep and they would kill us. When I arrived home, my mother was so sad, and I think I remember I had to sleep for about 2 days after this ordeal. Now, only 6 weeks later, precisely on the 14th, the night of 14th and 15th of May, our home was attacked again by about 24 tanks, which came to cut Gaza Strip. My home is close to Gaza Strip, but not in Gaza Strip. To cut Gaza Strip into two. And they came, and we have my brothers and cousins and so on. They had some old guns. They held them from about 10 o'clock at night till 6 o'clock next morning. But finally, of course, they could not continue to resist. And the Zionists came, and they blew up our homes and burned them. They also blew up the school which my father built in 1920. It's a primary school, which was our pride, because my father built that school at his expense in 1920 when he had no children. They also blew the what's called Bayara, which is a well, with motorized well, from which we drink, and also we water our gardens and plantations. Since that time, I spent many days and years, in fact, going through Europe's libraries, especially in London, but also in Paris and in Germany and Istanbul, trying to reconstruct the face of that invisible enemy to me, which destroyed my life ever since until today. What did we do to them? I never saw a Jew in my life. I never saw, of course, a Zionist soldier in my life. And I had to construct even not only who they were, but the names of the officers who destroyed my life. I got pictures of them. I got maps of how they made this operation. And through a friend of mine, an Israeli non-Zionist, he interviewed them last year, and he interviewed them one by one, including the officer who actually demolished the house, and the what they call political commissar, who was, you know, indoctrinating the soldiers, and also the intelligence officer. And they told him, "Yes, we know the name Abu Sitta quite well. We have feared that name because their family is known to control most of the area in that place, and they were the ones resisting the Zionist encroachment since the early days of the Mandate." In terms of facts, when the British Mandate took office in Palestine, they had the objective of giving Palestinians, the natural majority, a free democratic government. At the same time, because of colonial intentions, they have given a Balfour promise or declaration to establish a national home of Jews in Palestine. It says a national home, doesn't say a state. It says in Palestine, not of Palestine. So during the mandate period, they managed only to obtain a total of 5.5% of the area of Palestine and no more, because people will not sell their patrimony, although there has been laws which are discriminatory to the Palestinians. They apply taxes on them to force them to sell land, but even in the end, they could not do more than 5.5% of Palestine. They were able to bring in Jewish immigrants to Palestine so that the Jewish population rose from 9% at the beginning of the mandate to 30% at the end of the mandate. And this population was highly militaristic. They selected young men of military age. Many of them have been veterans of Second World War, and they managed to put in an army of 120,000 trained soldiers. By comparison, the Palestinians had only home guards of about 20 or 30 in each village, a total of which does not exceed 2,500. So it was a foregone conclusion who is going to win. And there is, of course, the fallacy that the Jews were outnumbered by the Arabs. This is never true. In any battle, as now history books show, they were outnumbering Palestinians by 4-1. So Ben-Gurion made a policy of taking over Palestine even before the British left. And he managed to expel half of the total refugees before the middle of May 1948, which is the end of the mandate, and before the state was established. And ironically, he expelled the people who are Palestinians from the state where they are supposed to remain as citizens in the Jewish state. But of course, the ethnic cleansing policy was a fundamental principle of Zionism, that we want the land, we do not want the people. The State of Israel was established on the 14th of May 1948 on 13% of Palestine. So they conquered an extra area from 5.5 to 13%. And at this moment, all the countries which had recognized Israel de facto, in fact, recognized it on only 13%. Later, of course, the Israelis were able to conquer 78% of Palestine. And therefore, theoretically speaking or legally speaking, those who recognize Israel as de facto, they should not have recognized Israel on the extra amount of Palestine which it conquered. The ethnic cleansing was almost complete. 675 towns and villages, Palestinian towns and villages, were depopulated. Only 99 remained. This systematic expulsion was a deliberate one, although there are sometimes arguments whether this is clear in documents or not clear. That is of no relevance, because what you should see is what actually happened. The system was like this. They instituted or they committed a massacre at the beginning of every military operation. There has been 30 military operations in 1948 to conquer Palestine. At the beginning of each, there was always a massacre. Deir Yassin is the famous or infamous one. But actually, in Dawaima, the people who were massacred by smashing the babies' heads and so on were much larger than that. And in the north, in Galilee, there has been a tremendous number of massacres. And they used to say, if you don't leave, the fate of such and such village will be yours. And the standard method used was to circle the village from three sides, leaving the fourth open. This fourth side, which remains open, was pointing to Lebanon in the north, so that people go to Lebanon and Syria, and pointing to the east in the central part of Palestine to go to Jordan. And in the south, the open side was to the south, so that they could go to Gaza. The people who were depopulated represented 85% of the Palestinians who lived in the conquered land. Only 15% remained, and we know what happened to them. They are now about 1 million, and they live even now under second-class status. By July 1949, Israel signed armistice agreements with Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. And the armistice line was created. Legally speaking, the armistice line has no value in that it doesn't confer or deny rights to anybody. It simply is the temporary line at which forces stopped on that day. With time, this line became like an international border. But in international law, it is not a border. It's only a temporary line of the cessation of hostilities. Now, this sounds simple when you say it. But in fact, 111 villages have been decimated by this line. Most of them are in the West Bank, and others about 5 or 7 in Gaza. Here you see people coming, officers from the United Nations, accompanied by Israeli officers and some Arab officers, whether Jordanian or Egyptian, walking through, cutting through the land of a village, and the well or the water supply they have falls on the wrong side, or the fields are on the wrong side, or sometimes in villages the line goes through the middle of the village. And people of the village would be crying, screaming, shouting, and say, how come you decimate our land? How come this is our patrimony? How come suddenly this land of mine becomes across the barbed wire, I can't go there? How come we have no water because our water sources are on the wrong side? How come our school and cemetery be outside of our reach? Many people in the world who believe in justice say that the Palestinians, like anybody else, have the right to return home, because there is nothing more basic than the right to live in your home. The sanctity of private ownership is something sacred. The English call my home is my castle, because that is where one finds security. Not only that, for Palestinians, not only security, but it's the patrimony of the family. It is not uncommon to find families in Palestine named after their villages, like Nablus, Nablusi, like Fallujah, Fallujah. And their history, goes back, not only during Islam, which is 1400 years ago, not only during Christianity, which is 2000 years ago, but even up to 5000 years ago. There is evidence, strong evidence, that the Palestinians never left Palestine en masse. The only time in the last 5000 years in which they have been depopulated en masse from Palestine is in 1948. And even then, still half of the Palestinians still live in the land of Palestine. And in fact, 88% of all Palestinians live within 100 miles around Palestine and in Palestine itself. As I have shown in many studies, 97% of the refugees live within 100 kilometers away from their homes, and 50%, half of them, live within 40 kilometers, a mere bus ride. And of course, in Israel itself and in the West Bank, many people actually see their homes, and they are not allowed to return to their homes. This anomaly, this grave injustice, could not possibly continue, even though it is now held by the power of the gun and the power of F-16 and the trail of blood and destruction which is happening in Palestine and have been happening for 58 years. If the Palestinians are not strong in their belief in the right to return home, they would not have withstood 58 years of wars and destruction and brutal occupation. Nobody, in my knowledge and to the best of my estimate, nobody could stand that onslaught for 58 years. Civilian people, unarmed people, do not have arms, sophisticated arms, do not have financial support from various countries in the West, do not have political support, yet they are adamant in restoring their right to their homes. Why? Because it's part of the making of the human being that you have an identity, and you have this identity is tied to your patrimony. People in Palestine know that their parents and the grandparents are buried in the same spot. People belong to that place. Even now, I have seen examples of young people, when they get married, they go around the world finding the family which lives down the street, and they marry as if the geography has not severed their lives. I have seen examples in New York, for example, when a boy meets a girl and he knows that she is from that village or related somehow, they get married. In other words, they defy the severance of their geography and they maintain continuity of their history. And the return, in fact, is embodied in the simple idea that a nation's history and geography should be united. And now for the Palestinians, they are separated, but that is their quest, to unite their history and geography. Resolution 194, which is very famous among Palestinians, which has been affirmed by the United Nations many times, over 100 times, says that the Palestinians have the right to retain their homes, and in addition, they have the right for compensation. It is a simple matter in compensation law that if you cause damage to anybody, you are obliged to remove that damage or to replace it or to compensate for it. This is a simple fact. It's very well known. When you are driving and you hit somebody's car, you have to pay for it. So in international law, and with the experience of Kosovo and Bosnia and Iraq, the machinery for carrying out the compensation is now well established by the United Nations. What does that mean? It means that you have a personal compensation for material losses. That is to say, they have used your fields and your land for 58 years. They must give you the revenue from this property for all these times. In fact, there is a United Nations resolution which is reaffirmed every year in November, which says the Palestinians are entitled to the revenue of their property for 58 years, and it obliges Israel to put this in a special account pending settlement. That is for the material compensation. Now, people say, if somebody doesn't want to return. Now, if they don't want to return, which by all counts will be a minimum number of people, then their property is offered to sale naturally to another Palestinian. Then he can buy it from the non-returning refugee. But both of them are entitled to the revenue from their property. And also, they are entitled to compensation for repairing of the damage which has taken place. Today, as we speak, thousands of Lebanese are forced to leave their homes in south of Lebanon, and thousands of Israelis are forced to leave their homes in northern Israel because of hostilities. Nobody would suggest that when the hostilities cease, that these people are not allowed to return. So, regardless of the reason why refugees left, that is no excuse whatsoever to pretend to prevent their return. It's a fallacy used. In fact, we know now it's well established that Ben-Gurion and the Zionist system in 1948 did everything possible to prevent the return of the refugees. First, they shot everyone who dared to go back. They shot them in the spot. They called them infiltrator. Second, they demolished their homes and villages and so on. Third, they burnt their crops. They also poisoned their wells. And then they established a political policy saying that we cannot allow the refugees back because they are going to be a fifth column. At the same time, they brought in Jews, firstly from Arab countries, who were readily available, to replace them. I have shown in my studies, had the refugees not being expelled from their homes, it would not have been possible for those Jewish immigrants from Arab countries to come to Israel, because they lived in Arab homes. So if the Arabs are still there, they could not have got them. And therefore, the Arab Jews, we call them Arab Jews, who came from Arab countries, were only able to immigrate to Israel because the Palestinians have been expelled from their homes. Now, the Israelis sometimes say that there should be an international fund to pay compensation for the Palestinian refugees for their property. There is a fallacy in this in many ways. First of all, the compensation is a right for the Palestinians after they return. When they return, everyone will calculate how much damage and loss he suffered, and then compensation can be paid. Palestinians are absolutely united in never accepting compensation as the price of their homes. And they say, our homes and country are not for sale. So this principle is rejected totally. Now, Israel wants to advance this idea of an international fund in order to resettle the Palestinians anywhere in the world, from Lebanon and Jordan to Canada and the United States. They are ready to help the Palestinian refugees settle anywhere in the world except in their homes. As I said, this is definitely rejected. Now, what is the idea of establishing an international fund? Israel's idea is that, as I said, to take over the real estate property of the Palestinians, which comprises 93% of the area of Israel today. It will also take over the property in 675,000 villages. It will take over all the public amenities in the country and ask someone else to pay for this, and on the condition that Israel will be in the end the legal owner for the Palestinian property paid for by others. And they want to make that a condition such that there will be no demand of Palestinians after that, neither for the return to their homes nor for any other kind of compensation. In other words, Israel would ask the world to pay for all the property and the land it has confiscated from Palestinians, and it will end up by being the legal owner, signed by the original owner himself, that he doesn't have any property anymore, and consider this to be a fair solution. This is far from it and would never be accepted by the Palestinians.
That was an address by renowned Palestinian geographer, researcher, and author Salman Abu Sita, titled The Geography of Occupation. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live at www.wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the WZBC archive found on the homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.